Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection, where we interview marketers and entrepreneurs to hear the stories they tell about their brands. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. This is a podcast by humans, for humans, who also happen to be marketers. On this week's show, our guest is Nick Kramer.
Nick is the president of Driven Leads, a conversion consulting firm that specializes in the real estate industry. Their sole focus is improving the customer experience while achieving maximum ROI for their clients. Their core solution is built around generating traffic, leads, and clients through Google AdWords and Facebook marketing campaigns. Nick and his team keep an eye on the latest trends and technologies and are always looking for the next project to conquer.
Although Nick has hooked us on the term, the riches are in the niches, his insight on everything from your marketing language to ROI tactics within the niche context of Driven Leads is applicable to marketers across industries.
We had a great discussion with Nick, and I especially love his take on why getting hyper-focused in his business leads to those riches. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Nick Kramer. Hi, Nick. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to start with what your focus is today. And so can you give us a high-level overview for what Driven Leads does?
Yeah, Driven Leads is a lead generation solution, predominantly working in the real estate industry. So we work with residential real estate brokers and agents, generating leads on sites that they own and operate. We've got about 140 clients to date across the country and manage about $250,000 a month up to $500,000 a month in ad spend inside Google, Facebook, and Microsoft.
So we know you somewhat stumbled into this field of work. So we would love to hear a little bit more about how you got to this position and where you are today.
Yeah, I started doing Google Ads marketing as a hobby. I used to run a web hosting company and sort of to pass my time, I would help a bunch of our clients on that side doing Google AdWords, what it was referred to back then. And had a family friend reach out and say he needed help in the real estate side. It was no different than any other account that we'd run. So jumped in, helped him out with it, and actually did a better job than he had experienced before. And he started telling all of his friends across the country about us. And before we knew it, we had about 30 clients that I wanted to be a consultant and ended up starting a firm because I needed employees. So it was a nice accident, but we didn't have any intentions of jumping into the real estate industry or into doing lead generation when we started it. And it was a nice to be able to pivot from web hosting into lead gen because it's a much, much more enjoyable program.
That's great. And you know, we talked last time just about sort of your work within real estate and wanted to sort of ask you around, have you considered, you know, sort of branching out beyond real estate?
Yeah, we have. We work with a couple of other clients in a couple other verticals. We work in the security market. We've got some mortgage lenders we work with. We've got one chiropractor that's, you know, family friend as well. It's lead generation in that industry or in all those industries and verticals there's similarities to them. Mm-hmm. For us, we really look at it and we say the riches are in the niches. We can be a lot more efficient. We can be a lot better for our clients if we know day in and day out what that market looks like and what the industry is doing. But yeah, we've definitely, you know, thought about going into other markets and have for a couple of one-off systems. I wouldn't say never because I never thought I'd be working with real estate agents before. Right. I got into it. So yeah, there's definitely an opening for opportunities in other verticals for sure.
Yeah, I love the statement, there's riches in the niches. And you know, one of our big influences has been April Dunford's book on product positioning called Obviously Awesome. And some of the best advice from the book is really to start with a narrow focus and that you can really always broaden later, right? But to get really sort of good at the thing that you're really focused on. And so, you know, can you just talk a little bit about how that has kind of helped you guys, you know, sort of move forward? And it sounds like that's sort of a big part of, you know, kind of how you run your business.
Yeah, there is a good quote somebody just said the other day is nobody is born a specialist or knows what they're doing until they have to start from somewhere. So really the beauty in it for us is getting started with the solution and then being able to replicate it 100 times. Obviously you get better at it, and as we get new opportunities and inside the market, we see new things and we're able to track that back to other accounts and do it for other clients. So really when we have clients come to us and want to try new things, we're always up for it because of the fact that it's going to allow us to sharpen that sword and help the rest of the clients, downline from them that might be wanting to do that too. The niche stuff really, it makes us a lot more efficient than we would be. Allows us to have a lot smaller staff, which is great on the business side of things for me, but my staff's a lot more efficient than they would be if they were doing 15 different verticals and having to change their mindset every time they jump into a new account. That mindset stays constant. The efficiency goes through the roof, and it really helps us in the long run.
Yeah. And as someone, myself, who's always data first, I'm impressed and frankly jealous at how repeatable your model is for your clients. And so can you talk about how that helps you be, as you refer to yourself as an ROI-based marketing firm?
Yeah. So with our clients, the fact that we can do repeatable work and the fact that we know pretty well if our client does their job in the lead follow-up, we're pretty sure we're going to do our job in lead generation. So it allows us to not run contracts. So we don't have 6 month, 3 month or 1 year contracts. We don't charge a setup fee, and we charge a pretty low entry fee in the world of marketing. When we tell other marketers and we mastermind with them what we charge, they say you're not charging enough. But at the same time, we look at it and saying, well, we can push that discount to our clients because we're doing that repeatable, and we're doing that with each and every client that comes through. So being able to do again, to repeat that and have that run again and again and again, makes it a better price point for our clients. It makes it again easier for me to run a business and not have to continue to reinvent the wheel each time.
Yeah. And I think from our perspective, working with, sort of companies of all different shapes and sizes, and when you work with, let's say even within a particular vertical, you're working with two different software companies, their sales, marketing and sales funnel might look completely different, right? Like it might be totally different sales cycle lengths and sort of the way you're going to define attribution, the way you're going to sort of count how much marketing had at hand in X, Y, or Z. Every time you're sort of building something from scratch. And so I was, again, especially taken from, just sort of like kind of like the high level math you're able to do pretty quickly, like the back of the envelope stuff, right? In terms of, the value of a lead. And if you convert those at 1%, it's pretty easy. And it's pretty easy, frankly, to see how that's such a great sort of selling point for your clients to be able to articulate much more clearly what they're going to be able to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's again, where that ROI-based marketing goes, is we tell them we'll do our job and we know we're going to deliver within this, within this price point for your lead cost. We never want to guarantee anything. We always be very conservative with our numbers, but we say, if you do your job, your ROI should start at this. And honestly, you can double it with your efficiencies. And we will help them on the back end of that. And they might come to us and say, hey, we're having problems with efficiencies here and there. We can go and say, well, let's, are you doing this? Are you trying this? Or connecting them with another vendor that we know in the space that does a good job of helping them with their lead follow-up, or somebody that does a good email solution, that does a good email follow-up drip program too. So all things that we don't really do, we stay again super focused on just the lead gen side of things. And after that, we can help them piece the rest of their stuff together. But we try to stay focused on our one thing. And you do that one thing great, then greatness can be multiplied hundreds of times.
And I think something that's also really important that you brought up is that staying within a niche and giving that really great experience for your employees to be efficient also makes for a great experience for the people that are your clients. And so I think a lot of times when people think about narrowing their focus or offering a discount or something, it's always, oh, well, this is going to hurt my business. And so I think the really important lesson here is that both of those things have actually worked to your business advantage.
Yeah. And not at first on purpose by any means. I'm not going to tell you I'm a genius and I can see into the future with that, but yeah, it really does. Our employees, like every one of my employees, I was just interviewing one last week and saying, I need you to wear multiple hats because we're a small firm, works with a lot of clients. But if they come in and ask a question about something, you have to be proficient in that stuff there. And then also be proficient, them being proficient in the jargon that comes with real estate and understanding there's a long cycle to purchasing and selling. And that's big for our clients to understand that too. So they don't come in and have to explain to my employees, this is how the sales process works. So this is what's going on in our market. We can go look at numbers and be like, all right, we see that inventory is low in your area. Then maybe we should start to do some seller valuation and try to get you some listings over top of trying to push a ton of buyer leads. So yeah, it really, when you niche down and you're able to, again, get proficient in that. And that's another reason we haven't jumped out is I don't have a big enough staff to say, okay, I want to get heavy handed in security or in Cairo, because I need to have people that speak the language, that understand what the client's needs are and what their wants are. And then for us to find the right mix with people, we actually do another thing that is kind of odd to the market is we interview our potential customers. And there's a lot of people that aren't ready for us. So we'll give them some tools and say, hey, go get better at this, or you might want to go into this set. If we go into another niche and we don't know that these people aren't ready for us, then we might be jumping the gun and pushing a ton of leads to them. And then all those leads fall on the ground because they didn't know what they were doing with it. They weren't ready for it.
Yeah. And you spoke my language with that answer, because yeah, I always say any subject or field that you're going into, you have to know how to speak that language, because every different group has their different way of conversing. And so that is really important. And something that we actually noted the last time that we spoke to you within your language that really interested at least me was that you mentioned that you have, quote, no theories. And I was very interested about what that means for you and your business. If you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's no secret to the world that I wasn't the greatest college student ever. So I also was trying to carry a full-time schedule and a full-time party schedule. So I'm not a huge fan of when I just hired a new employee a couple months ago. She comes in from the background of, I graduated a degree in marketing, this and that. And I said, the theories are great, but they don't work in the real world. And I'll say the same thing to my clients and say, yeah, in theory, somebody's telling you that you should get this, this, and this. But until we put, rubber meets the road, until you put your money up, we can, instead of working on theories, we can work on facts and basis of numbers. And I really think a lot of people like to talk in theory. I think obviously the Wall Street talking heads are really good at speaking in theory on this should work or that should work. And I hate theories, because theories can be blown up pretty quickly when you actually apply something and apply that science and find out that, oh, we were off 65%. Well, that's a massive number. Even being off 20% when you're talking a large scale is huge. So that's why when people come to us and say, well, in theory, this should work this way and this way, I always tell them, I don't work in theories. I work in the real world and in facts. And if you're willing to put up money to it, and there'll be times that we'll have a client that will come to us and wants to try something that we've never tried and haven't done it at all, then I tell them, well, I'll run the OPM theory. That's the only theory I live by, is other people's money. I'll use your money, try it, try your theory, and then we'll find the facts for it. And I won't charge you a fee for us to try that, but then we're going to learn off of your, off of you being upfront and wanting to try that. And that's where a lot of our stuff has come from, as we've had clients that have come to us and said, we trust you. We think you're going to do well with this. Can we spend money doing this and this? And we tell them straight out, well, we won't charge you for it. We'll figure out if it's valuable to you, and we'll figure out if it's real, it really works. And if it does, we'll start billing after that. I'm not a huge fan of the whole theory world.
No, it makes sense. And then, can you talk about, within that, obviously the thing you kind of keep coming back to is around data. And I'm interested how you guys incorporate testing, especially, and how do you find, again, so how do you work those, again, not necessarily being pro theory, but how do you test those hypotheses and, find sort of the course of action that works best for you guys?
Yeah. So when we're running, like a test or trial campaign, we're going to tag it differently. So it hits that client's CRM with a specific tag on, hey, this lead came from here and here, and this is, this is one of our trials. Let's see if this works. We might run it for, a week. We typically like to run stuff for a month or longer, depending on what the client's okay with. But as we run that, we're also following up with that client. And this is where I think we really do well is the communication lines. I mean, we have competitors in our industry that just don't communicate with the client and say, here are your leads, you're welcome. We like to call up and say, what do these leads look like? And let's go look at the tags, because we tag these on purpose. So that, that test and that trial we're running, you know, what are your notes on it? Because these guys are putting notes on every lead that comes through. So if we come through and say, well, what's that lead look like on your side? Is it good? Is it bad? Are you getting a lot of good feedback? Is there some warm stuff in there? So they're able to give us that gauge in the back end and say, yeah, this works. So we, you know, if they tell us it's a dog, it doesn't work at all. It's not, nothing's working there, then we're able to shut that down. A great example of that is when we're working in Google, we always tell the client, you should look at Microsoft.
Right.
Because the traffic is, you know, it's a tenth of the traffic, but at the same time, there's some really good hidden gems in there. It's an older demographic, more apt to pick up the phone if you're calling. So we'll always tell them, but then we'll have that caveat. Hey, you've got it. We're going to test it. You've got to tell us what those leads look like. They're going to tag different. So really when we're working on that testing, we're looking at our numbers and our data. You know, we're data people. We love the analytics of everything, and we love to see what's the time on site, what's the conversion rate, you know, what's the bounce rates look like. All that stuff, we can come to the client and say, we like this traffic, we like what it's doing. What does it look like in real life? Because we're looking at data black and white. We don't know the true feeling of that lead on the other side. So I think connecting those two really allows us to be a lot more effective for our clientele.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I love how you talk about really setting yourselves up for success, right? I love the interviewing the client approach as well, and making sure that they're ready for you, which, you know, again, I think a lot of companies don't necessarily see it as a two-way street, right? It's no, if you're ready to write the check, then we're ready to get working. And I think it's great that you guys are setting yourselves up for success. And frankly, wanting to go the extra step, as we kind of just talked about, to really be a partner of the client and to make sure, again, to really to figure out what's working so you can kind of put that back into the top of the funnel. And the last time we were talking, you made a really interesting statement that I kind of took note of around that there's a lot of realtors think that their headshot, let's say, is what helps them sell property, but that's not necessarily sort of a theory you agree with. So you kind of tell us what you feel helps them put their best foot forward.
Yeah. So the industry is starting to slowly adjust, and they're a slow to move industry than the real estate world and with agents and brokers. When we first started working, all of them said, let's drop them on a website with, you know, I've got this photo that I've got and my website's awesome, but they wanted to go to about me. And like I told them, you know, it's not all about you. It's all about what they're looking for. They didn't look for best looking realtor in XYZ town. They're looking for a home within the price of $250 to $350, and they want to see in this market or in this neighborhood. So we're pretty big on telling the clients, it doesn't, you know, you don't matter until that person becomes a lead and you can start to do branding. Now, branding in the back end, sure, get your photo up there, get your brand name up there, tell them that you're there for anything they need. But in the front end, it's a long cycle for buying cycle for, and it's the largest purchase that any person's going to make in their life is buying a home or selling a home. So it's a huge deal. But at the same time, they come in a specific reason. You know, we tell them, show your value after that, show it inside an email, show it inside your follow-up, but your photo and who you are does not matter at the front end. And I say this, and this is true for every single marketing firm in America. If they're running traffic in the internet, they should understand that America's inherently lazy. If I go and pull up my phone and say, hey Siri, show me this, this, and this, and then I get sent to the homepage of a website, you know, Amazon's a great example. If I did a search for something on Amazon raises their hand and says, yeah, I got that, and they take you to the homepage, how upset would you be? Like, are you kidding me? Now I have to search for this again? And granted, it's like a 3-second move, but everybody's bouncing if you do that. So when we tell agents that, like, we need to show them exactly what they want when they want it. And then we, even after that, we only have a 10% chance of getting them to sign up. So we need to do what they want. And again, that's, you know, those are hard line facts that we have. There are some agents that want to work on theory. So we let them run on theory, take them to the other landing page and show them you're wrong. It does need to be this way. But yeah, we're pretty upfront with our clients. You know, we tell them that we look at it as a partnership. We're not charging you for the 20 hours it takes for us to set this up. We're not giving you telling you that you have to run a contract. So at the same time, we want them to know that we're pretty transparent in what we do. And we're going to be pretty transparent on that's dumb, don't do that. Well, I'll say it nicely. But it, you know, I do have some clients that have been with us for like 7-8 years, and I've become, you know, friends with some of them, and like they'll call and have this really harebrained idea. I'm like, no, that's dumb. Don't do that at all. So, and they appreciate that. They understand, yep, I'm coming from a good place when I'm telling them that. But yeah, it's sometimes you have to set, and it's setting client expectations, like letting them know this is what you should expect from us, and you shouldn't do this. And if we do it the right way, you should be successful.
Yeah, you know, Jeff and I actually were talking about this just Friday, I think last week, about the power of front-end marketing and how if you can't get people in the door, then all of your back-end and future initiatives can be great, but no one's going to see them. And yep, so the power of understanding what's going to get people interested and hook them is something that a lot of times gets very underestimated, but is going to mess up all your other initiatives if you're not figuring that first step out.
Yep. Yeah. You can have the most amazing place to go, but if you don't have a bridge there over that river, you're never going to, you don't get them in, it doesn't get started, right?
Well, and the other concept I really love there is, you know, really what you're sort of talking about is the fact that a lot of, and this is true for companies of all shapes and sizes across all industries, and this is something we see all the time and work with our clients on, is how can you be more outside in as opposed to inside out, right? So it's really about, it's not your headshot, right? It's not about you. Any of your clients and customers, they want to know what problem can you solve for them, right? How can you make their life better? And so In the world of real estate, as we were sort of talking the last time, it's the knowledge that they have of their market. It's the social proof for what they've been able to do in the past. It's those things that are going to put somebody at ease that they're going to be comfortable working with you to make the biggest purchase of their life, right? But it's what problem can you solve for them? How can you make their life better? Not, you know, how's the lighting in your headshot, right? So,
yeah.
So then let me ask you, is it, you know, for somebody who, again, is pretty, you know, pretty sort of focused in that niche and seems like it's, you know, working effectively both from your perspective internally and for your clients, what are the things that are keeping you up at night, right? What are the new things now that you're looking at and saying, how do we get a step ahead? You know, what's sort of next on the horizon, if there is such a thing?
Every market will have something that goes through the progressions. You know, right now, everybody would always come in and ask us, you know, what about Zillow? How do you beat Zillow? Well, we beat Zillow very easily, and Zillow was never a problem. The funny thing is Zillow's starting to really be a benefit for us because they're showing their hand and they're showing that they're actually actually going to be a brokerage. They're going to start charging 35% finder's fee to everybody that gets a lead from them, which is an absolute, I mean, people are blowing up about it. They can't stand that mm-hmm. idea. So we used to have that where people would stay up at night wondering what, you know, what's going to happen with that. Right now, Google is the issue. Honestly, Facebook is the issue. You know, they're having problems, and they're getting, you know, in trouble with the government because of the way they handle the elections. So they're cracking down on stuff they shouldn't crack down on, or they're trying to limit abilities of you know, advertisers that have nothing to do with political stuff. And they're getting a little bit over, you know, heavy-handed on that and suspending a ton of accounts in Facebook that there's no reason for it. With us, we have to abide to the housing, the equal housing laws. So that and RESPA are a big deal. You know, RESPA coming back and being a little bit more heavy-handed is something that we have to be cognizant of for our clients. But Google wants more and more to try to get in touch with. And as an advertiser, they're trying their best to get through you and to the client and say, hey, there's a ton of stuff not going right on your account. You should take a look at this. So we get calls every week from Google trying to do that to us, and then getting in touch with our clients and telling them, oh my gosh, wouldn't you know, your account's messed up here and here, and you're losing 80% of your impression share. Well, the reason they're losing that is because they don't have a $40,000 a month budget. And they don't want these leads that Google thinks they do. So Google's an issue for us, and it has been in the last 9 months. They've been really heavy-handed on having these companies be contractors and claim that they're Google representatives when they're technically not. They're not even a 1099 employee of Google. So they're going out and they're making our job difficult because we have to go back and explain to our customers, these guys don't know what they're talking about. They don't have any clue what's good for you, what isn't. So that's an issue. I mean, other than that, really, things are really good for us. And those things, you know, we don't let those bother us too much. It's a couple hours a week that we have to deal with it. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, the biggest issues that we see is, you know, how much more are we going to be locked down? Like the iOS 14 isn't a big deal to us. They're talking about locking down, tracking and remarketing, retargeting. That doesn't affect us as much with our clientele. Because when we're doing our tracking and our remarketing to them, you know, we usually have them, you know, they've already signed up with us and already became a lead. So that helps on the Facebook side of things. We don't do cold traffic inside Facebook. So yeah, the biggest issue right now is Google, honestly,
yeah.
the government coming to them. And I understand why the government's doing what they're doing, mm-hmm. but at the same time, they're making it difficult for everybody when they should just, you know, focus on what the true task at hand is.
Yeah. And on one hand, I mean, I totally understand it's a pendulum, right? And it was set probably too far one way. And now that, you know, probably some overcorrection and, you know, I'm sure it'll find its way back. I think my favorite version of this, and you kind of called it out, is when, and we see this on behalf of some of our clients as well, is like, hey, did you know you're missing out on X percent of the impression share? You know, it makes it sound like, and for me, it's always funny because I always say as the numbers guy, it's like, it's not about impression share. It's about efficiency, right? If we've proven the efficiency and if we know that this really is an ATM and every dollar we put in, we get five in return, then sure, let's get every available impression. But right. Until we've gotten there, then, you know, there are, you know, we have those budgets and we have those sort of guardrails in place for a reason. And yeah, you're right. Yeah. So Google loves to, you know, kind of go around and say, hey, here's what you're missing.
Right. Yeah. They're fun with that. And the funny thing is that when we point that out to the clients, like, hey, here's your impressions that you're missing. So it's the three same things every time. So when they call, I usually hit them with that. I'm like, yeah, okay, so I need to change the attribution model, this and this. I need to do, you know, I need to change, because they want, the attribution model is never what they want. They prefer something else every time. They want impression shares to be higher. And then they want you to open up your keyword sets to allow for rentals, apartments, cheap. Like those are all keywords. What they don't understand, because a lot of them, unfortunately, have never bought a house and don't live in the US, so they don't understand that apartments and stuff like that aren't single family homes of what people are trying to purchase. So it makes for an interesting conversation every time we have this.
Yeah.
Well, to switch to a slightly more positive note, one question we always like to, do you like that seamless transition?
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. So to switch to a slightly more positive note, one thing we always like to ask in a personal or professional sense, wherever you want to take this, is how do you define success? What does that mean to you?
Success for me as an entrepreneur is being able to control my destiny, so to speak. I don't look at it as a monetary thing. You know, being financially free and being able to do what I want when I want is a big thing, but really success for me is being able to coach my children in any sport I want, being able to travel every time they need to, you know, we want to travel with them, being able to provide for my employees as well, and making a positive insight into their lives and being able to talk to them about what they want and their goals are. That's success for me. You know, I'm also driven, success is driven by competitiveness in growing up and playing sports at a high level. And my wife did as well, her being a college athlete. We're successful because we still look at everything as a sport. Like I look at my market as I want to be the number one in my market, and whoever is number two or number three that I hear about, then what are they doing right? What are they doing wrong? And how can we get an advantage on them? And how can we corner that market even more? And that's success. For me is to be, you know, to have the clients that we have and to know that people consider us the top, you know, top company to work with in our market. That would be success. And yeah, money comes from that, and being financially free comes from that. But my success is based on if I want to go out and play in the snow, or if I want to go out and spend 2 hours mowing my lawn because it keeps me away from having to talk to people, then that's that defines my success, right? So that's how I look at it. Kind of odd, but I think that's my view on it.
No, I always say once an athlete, always an athlete. So appreciate the context. I'm really hoping that you get to the point of, you know, recording meetings you have with clients and then breaking down the film afterwards and going back and, you know, sort of like.
It's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah. And so one of the other things we love to ask is what resources would you recommend to our audience? Again, these can be, personal, professional, inspirational, motivational, anything, books, blogs, podcasts, anything that you've come across that you think would be good to share with the audience.
So resources, obviously Google Analytics is going to set you free. If you learn, how to use Google Analytics properly, then, we don't use it as much as we typically need to, but using Google Analytics, Google Data Studio has really opened up opportunities for us in the long term. Like using that as a reporting tool really shows value to our clients too. They absolutely love having a link to Google Data Studio and getting a reminder each week to look at it. For running a business, honestly, get mentors, like ask questions. I didn't do that enough when I was younger and I paid dearly for it. I tell anybody that tells me they're an entrepreneur, I'm really big in promoting and helping young entrepreneurs and people that are aspiring to run their own business. So I tell them right out of the gate, if you're making over 100K a year and you don't have an accountant or and an attorney that you know, like, and trust, then go ahead and quit that job or quit that company and go back to the working world, because you're going to lose everything eventually, because you're going to make a mistake and either the government's going to come or somebody else is going to come, on the legal side of things. So those are important tools that I think are good to have. And then for reading, I have a obsessive compulsive personality. So I don't read as much as I used to, because when I read, I'll sit down and read the entire book from front to back and I can't walk away. So when I do read, I read a couple things very precisely. Honestly, the Perry Marshall's 80-20 book, 80% of your income comes from 20% of your output, and then really shaving it down to 95-5 and doing stuff like that. That book, the 80-20 business mindset, marketing mindset book that he wrote is based off the Pareto principle, mm-hmm. The 80-20 principle. There is a lot of truth to that. And if you start at that base point and look at it, essentially what that's telling you is, don't worry about the little stuff. If you're doing your checklist, start with your big stuff. And then when you get to the smaller stuff, that comes in more importantly or less important, but you can do it a lot faster. Those were big things for me on baselines, on figuring that out. And then just make sure you keep your mental health right. I am not a big fan of the people that talk about the grind and grinding 20 hours. I work 20 hours a day. Like, no, you didn't. You probably stood around for 16 and worked four, and you spun your wheels. Like, sit back, go, relax, watch something, exercise, get away from the desk, take your breaks, and really, you probably get a lot more done if you didn't grind 16 hours a day. Because that's just, in my mindset, that's foolish.
That's amazing. Yeah. Sophia and I have had plenty of those types of conversations again around, like, obviously it's a huge stigma in our society, frankly, that we wear as a badge of honor, right? Like, there's something, being busy somehow equates to being effective. And those two things are not necessarily one and the same.
Yep.
Yeah. The exciting game of, you got 3 hours of sleep. Well, I got 2 hours of sleep. Right. So like, really, you're just slacking here. Like, right. what are you doing with your time? No, yeah. I completely agree. And even if you are working 20 hours, like, personally, not something I would brag about. I'd be too tired to be bragging about it.
I'd hire somebody. If you're really putting up that much time and work, and then if you're not making money, get out of what you're doing, because, there's only so much time you can burn on that before you need to hire. I mean, yep. Hire quick, hire slow, fire fast is a big thing too. Mm-hmm. I don't hire fast enough. We'll wait until everybody's bursting at the seams with work and then say, maybe we should put somebody else on the staff here. So it happens.
Yeah, that's great. And then before we let you go, I just wanted to ask, where can people find and connect with you on social media?
Social media. I'm not super active. Do you want to see photos of my kids and my family? you can look up Nick Kramer on Facebook. I think it's Nick J. Kramer at Twitter. I actually just follow. I love Twitter for informational stuff. Like, in our industry, there's a lot of great people that post some stuff and you can follow them on there. I'm not a great follow in that sense. I've connected with a lot of my clients on Facebook, so I'm active there. But yeah, if anybody wants to find me on social media and see how cool I look in the family photos and all the sports that we do, then that's where you'll find me there.
Well, then how about where can people find Driven Leads, right? If they're yeah. saying to themselves, hey, you know, we want to find out if we should be a client.
Sure. DrivenLeads.com. Pretty straightforward there. We're on Facebook, but not super active. We are a real unique marketing firm where we've only spent in the last 12 years of business, $4,000, $5,000 marketing ever. So we're lucky with our referrals that we have and people, you know, showing up at the front door. So it goes against all of our marketing principles. And we tell people you got to spend money to make money. But maybe that changes this year. We always say we're going to start to get a little bit more active and get a little bit more video out there. But yeah, you can find us at drivenleads.com, and hopefully by the time you get there, there'll be more stuff up there, more information up there. But we answer our phone when it's called. We're on live chat nonstop. So if you need to find us, you'll be able to find us.
Yeah. Well, Nick, thank you so much for being here. And thanks for sharing your story with us.
I appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Nick. That was a great conversation with Nick. I can officially say that I'm jealous of how successfully they've been able to focus their business. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. In this week's episode, we ended up delving into a topic near and dear to our hearts, and nope, it's not data, it's work and productivity. So I first and foremost wanted to clarify that if you are subject to long work days due to circumstances beyond your control, by no means were we ragging on you and your situation earlier in the episode. Rather, this first footnote is directed at all of the people I know who instead boast about their skewed productivity to sleep ratio. So upon doing some digging, I want to emphasize that we all tire more easily than we think we do. In fact, only 1% to 3% of the population can actually sleep 5 to 6 hours a night without suffering some sort of performance drop-off. And before you start to say that you are part of that somehow small percent, well, it's possible. But keep in mind that for every 100 people who think they're a member of this cohort, only 5 actually are.
Yeah, I think that's something that we see a lot in life. Not to bring up more other research topics, but the fact that 80% of people think they're above average drivers. And there's a statistic out there around multitasking too, in much the same way that we as humans are really bad at it. But everybody always is going to immediately go to assume that they are in that small group. And, you know, I even find myself, as you're saying it, saying like, I think I can, you know, but what I will say for myself personally is, it's hard to know. You have to give yourself a comparison. So frankly, for your own self personally, just try getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep in a night or two, see how you feel the next day. And I think you'll find immediately for yourself that you'll find that boost in productivity.
Yeah. You know, Jeff, I think it's funny because we usually call ourselves the professional hype men. And here we are being like, you're not actually as good as you think you are. But I think in this case, the switch in mental framework is that you need to be better to yourself. And in order to do that, you need to actually be aware that you are a human being with human limits, and a lot of humans need sleep, believe it or not. And so that's something we really need to take into consideration, especially when we are trying to be our most productive professional and personal selves.
And even beyond sleep, though, there's again, just a lot of limits to productivity. And this is true across exercise. I've been listening to a whole lot of stuff around that where people think where it's just a matter of doing more. And in some cases, you're actually overtaxing your body. And there are a lot of situations, at least from an exercise perspective, that actually less is more, right? That doing less or doing less rigorous training because you have to actually train different zones of your heart rate, it is more actually the appropriate way. And I think putting that kind of same context on work, I think people think, well, if I'm getting 8 hours of work done, well, then wouldn't it just be more productive for me to do 10 or 12 or 14? And the truth is, there's a whole lot of research out there that shows that people actually see their productivity basically stop. You know, I believe the number was somewhere around 50, 55 hours. And so, sure, I know there is going to be situations, and when you're heading towards some sort of big important goal on a short term, I think that's certainly understandable. But I think the point is to recognize that as humans, we don't have the capacity or capability to do that on a long sort of ongoing basis, to say every week is always going to be that 70-hour week.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point. To be clear, we are talking about consistently long work days, not a hectic week that you have to put in those extra hours because push comes to shove, and we get it. And we've all been there, but most research suggests that that's only sustainable for a week or two. And beyond that, once it becomes a chronic overworking, that's the kind of problems that we're discussing, not an offhanded busy week. But we have a solution beyond everything that we've already discussed, because really, what would be the point in rounding out our data story if we don't give you some actionable upsides? So besides trying to get some more sleep, of course, as we previously mentioned, another interesting study that I found was an experiment that Harvard Business School's Leslie Perlow and Jessica Porter found that predictable required time off, like nights and weekends, actually make teams of, they did this on consultants, more productive. And so, okay, maybe you really feel that you have to bang out X amount of hours of work, right? But knowing this is when I end, this is when I won't be working, can actually make those hours more productive.
I think that's so important. And frankly, even if those endpoints are arbitrary, it's really important to keep a box around that for a lot of reasons. And look, we're all, you know, these days we're all working remotely. So we're all up against it. And we used to have, in a more traditional office setting, we used to have a more natural boundary where it was, well, when you left the office, it's, you know, you could leave stuff at the office. And yeah. Now when we're all in our homes, in many cases, while we're getting that work done, it's hard. I know this is something I'm bad at personally, where it's almost easier for me to let it sort of blend into sort of the rest of my day, the rest of my weekend, the rest of my weeks. And frankly, it makes a ton of sense as to why you'd want to box it. And I think ultimately, and look, we talk about this, Sophia, around the podcast or any sort of piece of work we're doing, is if we have 6 weeks, we could just keep tinkering and tweaking it. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any better than if we had set an arbitrary deadline and said that, you know, we're going to send this out on Friday.
Yep, precisely. And research supports that. So really, we're doing great.
Yeah. But again, I think time boxing is really important. And I think it helps give you that understanding of like, okay, and kind of it goes back to what you were just saying, Sophia, in terms of that you can do that for a short period of time. And I think it's easier when you see it as, okay, I just got to get up this hill for the next 2 hours to finish this thing. And then I'm going to step away. I'm going to eat dinner. I'm going to watch TV. I'm going to do whatever it is that is totally unrelated to this. So I have a deadline. And so therefore, even just creating deadlines, even if they don't exist, will just give you a better sense of being able to separate those things.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is easier said than done. One thing I actually found really interesting is in that Harvard Business School study, they had a really tough time getting the consultants to actually buy into, okay, at this time, you're really going to have to stop working because this is what we're trying to study. And so you're going to mess up the research if you don't do it. But once they started to see those productivity benefits a few weeks in, that's when they started to then be more okay with it. And so even in a regulated research study, this was difficult for participants to do. So by no means are we trying to say it's a light switch and, oh, you just have to turn off your work day and you'll be good to go. Like, we understand that it takes work, but that work has concrete data backing up its effectiveness. Ironically, the personal work, not the actual work.
Absolutely.
And that's it for footnotes.
Great. Well, thank you, Sophia. And as always, all of the research and references can be found in the show notes. And if you want to reach out to us directly about this story or to inquire about sharing your own story, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circinresearch.com. Thank you for listening. And we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circin Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circin Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circinresearch.com.